This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's been predicted that the Amazon rainforest would disappear within 75 years if the current rate of destruction continues. That could mean global warming and a loss of the plants whose extracts supply us with 25% of our prescription drugs. Adrian Cowell spent most of the 1980s filming the destruction of the Amazon and recording the stories of the people who live in the rainforest, make their living there, or make their living destroying it. His camera crews filmed the Amazon being burned, settled, ranched, farmed, and abandoned. He has footage of armed showdowns between homesteaders and the hired gunmen of ranchers. And Cal has documented the story of Chico Mendez, the rubber tapper and political organizer who was murdered in 1988. You can see Cal's work in a four-part series that premieres next Tuesday on the PBS series Frontline. The series and Cal's companion book are both called Decade of Destruction. Cowell is also the author of two other books about the Amazon. Last year, he won the British Academy Award for Lifetime Achievement for his documentary film work. In Decade of Destruction, Cowell says that, like Chico Mendez, he wouldn't describe himself as an environmentalist. There are no animals and few ecological scenes in his films.
There are many people who make extremely good films about the Amazon, about the ecosystem, about the animals, and about the whole nature of the Amazon. And those films can say what a pity it is to be destroyed, but they cannot explain why it is being destroyed, because the nature, the ecosystem, is passive. It is man that is the active force, and it is man that is destroying it. So what our series is about the political, social, and economic forces that produced the massive destruction of the Amazon during the 1980s. And you can actually see those forces overcome by the end of the decade. At present, our camera team is flying with the helicopters of the forestry police, and they say the fires are greatly down, and a lot of other people are saying the fires are greatly down. And I'm flying out to Brazil in a couple of days to interview the Minister of the Environment when we should have the final definitive figures. It does look as though the Brazilian government has changed its policy, and it does look as though it is being successful in reducing the fires. And so you're beginning to see a massive change in the politics of what was happening in the Amazon in the 1980s.
Your series opens with some incredible footage of a fire ravishing part of the rainforest, and there's one particularly interesting image of just a tree being burned in this holocaust-like flame, and the tree is kind of waving back and forth in the wind of the fire. Can you talk a little bit about that particular fire that you filmed?
Well, we filmed hundreds of fires. That particular one I think was fired by Renato. Renato was a colonist who we filmed for a number of years. They moved into this area, cut down the forest. You usually cut it in about May, at the beginning of the dry season, and you leave it to dry for as long as possible. And between August 15th and September the 15th, depending on how the weather is, you fire it. And you hope that as much will burn as possible, because it's very hard work to clear what remains. And Renato planted pretty soon after, towards the end of September, with the first rains coming in. And within 2 or 3 weeks, he realized something was wrong, and within 2 months, they realized that their land was so poor that it was really completely impossible for anything to grow. So what had happened was that the rainforest had been cut down. Some people had spent a lot of time and effort trying to make something out of it. They all got malaria. One of their sons nearly died of malaria, and it was completely useless. And at present, that particular state of Rondônia, 60% of the area that has been cut down is now either scrub going back to forest or the early pioneer forest coming in, i.e. that land, 60% of the land that was cut down has now been abandoned.
You actually spent a lot of time with homesteaders for your documentary series. Why have there been so many landless people in Brazil who've decided to try to settle in the rainforest?
In Brazil, there are 12 million landless poor. That is the government figure. Most of these people originally had land, or their fathers had land, and the process of the mechanization and capitalization of agriculture has forced them off the land. Also, in many cases, extremely violent methods used by the landowners and land speculators who hire gunmen to drive them off. And these things drive the people into the Amazon. The government in the early 1980s regarded the Amazon as a sort of dumping ground for social problems. They didn't want to face the problem which this question of landlessness in the developed part of Brazil caused, so they systematically advocated migration to the Amazon and gave away free land there. Of course, all that did was to transfer the problems that existed in other parts of Brazil to the Amazon, and the Amazon itself became an area of very vicious land feud. I mean, altogether over the 1980s, the Amnesty International figure is well over 1,000 murders as a direct result of land feuds.
It's I think, kind of a confusing situation if you haven't been following it. But you have these homesteaders trying to settle in the Amazon, and then you also have ranchers who are trying to clear the Amazon. So what's the relationship between those ranchers and the homesteaders?
The ranchers, in many cases, came in with massive government incentives. About 75% of the investment in a ranch can come from a big company's taxes given back to it if it invests in the Amazon. The idea is to try and get big companies to go to the Amazon. And they get very large areas of land. It is, of course, quite impossible to cultivate the whole of this area. And so in many cases, a lot of it's left as forest, and in many cases, it is invaded by migrants. And in Brazil, if you can stay on the land, if you are a squatter and you manage to stay on that land and cultivate it for 1 year and 1 day, you have the right to remain with that land permanently. And so this situation produces a lot of direct gun battles between the gunmen paid by the ranchers and by the squatters, who all have shotguns or a type of muzzle-loading sort of musket, really, which you push powder and shot and beeswax down on top of it, and it's reasonably effective.
My guest is Adrian Cowell, and he has a four-part Frontline series and a companion book called Decade of Destruction. It's about the destruction of the Amazon rainforest, and Cowell went on his first Amazon expedition in 1957, and he's also written two other books about the region. In telling the story of the squatters, you tell about how they'd come into the rainforest, burn land to clear it, plant on it, then find out that the soil just wouldn't support the crops. The crops just wouldn't grow, or enough wouldn't grow. But what they would do is abandon that land and move deeper into the forest. And that's something I guess I don't understand. If the forest was failing to provide good crops, why would they keep moving deeper and clearing more forest?
There are two things. If the land is extremely poor, then there's not much point. But there are better patches of land, there's no question. And Renato was the man I mentioned earlier who did abandon his land within 2 years. Within 20 or 30 miles, there was not too unreasonable land. The point is that what the nutrients of the forest are in the trees, not in the soil. So when you cut down the forest and burn it, you are actually putting the nutrients of the trees into that soil. And usually, if the land is more or less okay, you'll get a good crop the first year. You can plant rice. You may be able to get another crop a second year. After that, you more or less have to give it over to grass. And if you want to plant anything else, you have to cut down more forest. So you will get a colonist or a squatter will have a plot, say he has 100 acres. He will probably cut every year another 5 or 10 acres, constantly moving in. So it's just not a type of agriculture that works. And what does, the only way you can make it work is by cutting the trees, so each time you've got a new set of nutrients going into the soil, and those are exhausted or washed out by the rain within 1 or 2 years.
I think it's fair to say that a lot of Americans have the image of the rainforest being encroached on largely by agribusiness and large ranchers, you know, ranchers who own big tracts of land. But it seems that it's not only that, it's also landless peasants looking for a place where they could grow food and live. Do you think it's not easy to say who the villains are in this story?
Relatively easy it is to say. You do have, as you say, there are both ranchers, and those ranchers go there with a deliberate government program of incentives. And those incentives are tax rebates. Any company in the period when this worked could get a 25% return of its taxes every year, and you could, any ranch that you built up could have a total of 75% of its investment coming from these tax rebates. So basically that was just a handout by the government to the ranchers. In a similar way, the colonists were given free land surveyed by the government, and there were meant to be various forms of programs to help them. And of course, there is no real major deforestation in the Amazon without a road, and who built the roads were the government. And the reason why there's no deforestation without a road is you can walk into the forest, you can even plant your crops, but you can't get it out. So the people who go into the forest in advance are the people who are like the Indians. They just grow enough to eat. Or there were a number of previously Brazilian either rubber tappers or caboclos, who are a type of jungle peasant, who just lived there and who really didn't do any harm to the forest because they just cultivated a small area and was enough to live off, until a road was built. Once a road is built, you get the ranchers, you get the colonists, and you get land speculation coming in on a massive scale. So there's no question that what was going wrong in the Amazon was who was responsible. First of all, was the Brazilian government. It was a deliberate policy, and this policy was financed and assisted by the World Bank and the Inter-American Development Bank for a long period. So what we are seeing wrong before was a government policy that certainly was not good for the Amazon, and now we are seeing a government policy which wants to look after the Amazon and which wants to change the previous policy.
What were their government incentives to build roads through the Amazon and to settle it?
There are two main reasons. One was it came during the period of military dictatorship. There were 20 years of military dictatorship from about 64 to, I think, 84. The military, like all military, were frightened of invasion, and they have this vast empty space of the Amazon. They were frightened that someone would try and grab it from them. So they had a slogan, can't quite remember it now, but it more or less it means occupy the Amazon to integrate it into Brazil. And that was their plan. There was also the plan of all the economic developers, all the people who associated in the type of economics related to the World Bank, who want to see large areas of unused land being used, and they're being used particularly to produce cash crops. And these are cash crops for export, partly to pay off Brazil's international debt. And it was a system of economic colonialism.
You were, I believe, the first person to photograph this group of Indians who have basically tried to remain hidden from Brazilians. And how did you feel about photographing them?
Well, the anthropologists have often argued that these Indians should be left in the jungle on their own, and it is a complete intrusion on their life to deliberately go and make contact with them, which this government expedition did, and you can count the photography as a facet of that.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, this is true. In an ideal world, they should be left alone. In fact, what we learnt bitterly, what we saw, was that the government had deliberately left this tribe alone for as long as possible. The father of the head of the Indian Protection organization in that area, the head was called Apuena Morelis, and his father, 20 years before, had made a deliberate decision not to go into this area, not to contact these Indians, try and leave them as isolated as long as possible. Unfortunately, when this completely uncontrollable process of immigration and development started, they did not know the Indians well enough. They were unable to inoculate them properly. They didn't have sufficient influence on them to explain the problems of disease, flu, measles, and everything like that. And in this case, there's no question that the contact of that tribe had been left too late. If it had been done earlier, the Indians would have had more of a chance of understanding what was coming, of already being inoculated, of understanding the idea of medicines, and therefore the necessity when you get ill to travel to the post to get the medicines. And there's an extremely sad case that one in six of these Indians died. And certainly one of the reasons was that the contact was not early enough. The second reason, of course, was that there was no major government attempt to try and restrain the uncontrolled movement of the frontier into this area.
Do you think that there's any chance of the Indians who live in the rainforest forming any political coalitions to help save it?
Oh, they have. And I know these people well and have sort of watched them and talked to them over the years. And one of the things in my book is about the tremendous difficulty in the area of Xingu of the more than a dozen tribes that were in Xingu who naturally did not have a political organization, forming a political organization which was largely contrary to their traditions, but they formed it to fight in defense of their area, and the Xingu National Park grew out of this. And from the Xingu National Park grew the organization called UNI. It was the inspiration for UNI, and UNI is a national organization for all the Indians in Brazil. And surprisingly, the people in the forest who last formed a political organization to defend their interests were the rubber tappers, Brazilians who lived in the forest, but a Brazilian rubber tapper lives isolated while Indians live in a village. So the rubber tappers had much less tradition of working socially together in groups. And it was Chico Mendes, was one of the people who helped build up the rubber tapper organizations in trades unions. And when those trade unions joined together to try and form a national organization for all the rubber tappers in the Amazon, it was the Indians and UNI helped them. And the Indians and the rubber tappers now have an alliance. It's called the Alliance of the Peoples of the Forest. And so there are political organizations all the time working in defense of these people.
You know Chico Mendes very well. And I don't know if you've seen this, but there's a new book by Alex Shumatov.
Yes, I've heard of it. I haven't seen it yet.
It's called The World is Burning, and he's been a staff writer for The New Yorker. And this is also, it's a book about the Chico Mendes murder. And in the book, he describes you as the man who created Mendes. And he describes you as a kingmaker. And I wonder what your reaction is to that.
I feel very sorry that people denigrate Chico like this. And I don't mean that nastily. I'm sure he didn't mean it that way. He was saying it loosely. Chico Mendes was a very major success long before I ever came anywhere near him. He had helped found the union in Brasileia, and he founded the union in Chapuri, and these unions successfully defended the rubber tappers in their campaign against the ranchers. And when I went there, Chico was a political candidate for election and was a very well-established figure. The only thing that I did for him was that when he lost his campaign, and there are reasons for this which it's a bit complicated to go into now, he was extremely depressed, an extremely bad situation. And at that time, Chico was campaigning against a road being financed by the Inter-American Development Bank. And I had just come back from Washington from actually filming environmentalists campaigning against the World Bank. And I said that I thought that the environmentalists in Washington would help him, but because no environmental organization will do anything in another country unless the people of that country and the environmental organization specifically invite them, I said that he would only get support if they wrote a letter or if they sent someone. And this had been discussed a number of times. But when he lost, it suddenly became of much more interest to sort of take him away from his defeat a little bit. And so I did ring up one of these environmental organizations, which said, yes, if Chico would like to come and present his case to the Inter-American Development Bank, they would pay for his fare. So that's how Chico went abroad. I also nominated him for a couple of awards. One was the UNEP Award, the Global 500, and the other was one Better World Society in the United States. And I did this through an organization which I'm part of, which is the Television Trust for the Environment. And that was all. And I nominated him because I could not think of anyone who deserved an award more. I mean, Chico was a fully established man with a complete policy, politics, everything. The only thing that happened that may be slightly different was that he got support and attention from environmental groups after he went to Miami, which he didn't have before.
So you have no problem being a part of the story that you're also covering?
Absolutely not. I mean, Shiku was a friend of mine, and I liked him. I was covering him. The campaign was over. The political campaign was over. I rang up someone and made a contact. That's all. I mean, well, it's not very much, is it? And I hope anyone I film, if they want a contact and I have a contact, I'll make it for them. Yes.
Adrian Cowell is my guest, and he's completed a four-part series for Frontline on public television and a new book, both called The Decade of Destruction, about the destruction of the Amazon rainforest. You've called the 1980s the decade of destruction. What do you expect the big issues will be for the Amazon in the 90s?
Well, what it looks like is this summer, the fires are greatly reduced. And it looks as though through the satellite and through the forestry police, they now have sufficient control to, if not stop the fires, very significantly fine and punish anyone who does burn. So the real question is, what are you going to do with the Amazon? First of all, what are you going to do with the already deforested areas? And the minister, José Lutzenberger, is trying to get a major sort of campaign launched to teach the people in that area how to sustainably use the land that they've got. Then there's the question of, what are you going to do with the forest? The forest, I don't think, will survive politically. The forest could survive if it was all made a reserve. But what everyone has learnt in the Amazon is that a reserve is a government-created vacuum, and that just incites people to invade it. So the reserves themselves are not very successful. And it is much better to have areas where there are rubber tappers or Indians whose interest it is to protect that area and make an economic living out of it. To give you an example, one of the ways of using the forest is to create what's called extractive reserves, reserves for rubber tappers like reserves for Indians. José Lutzenberger signed decrees with the rubber tappers 2 or 3 weeks ago for the creation of 50 million acres of extractive reserves. Great problem now is how to make these areas increasingly economic and profitable, how to make them more efficient, how to give a greater income to the people who are already working in them. And that needs a lot of scientific research on the products that could be extracted from the forest. So you've got two sides. What do you do with the forest that's standing? How can you make it as economically valuable as possible so that it will survive? And secondly, what are you going to do with the areas that have been cut down and degraded? And very fortunately, at the Group of Seven meeting in Houston this year in July, the governments of the seven richest countries welcome the new stance that Brazil was taking on the Amazon, and they have promised direct economic and other aid to help try and do something about the Amazon forest, to help try and preserve it.
Will you continue to work in the Amazon?
10 years is enough, you know. I probably will go back sometime, but the series was a decade. Thank goodness it wasn't a century.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, thank you too.
Adrian Cowell, his new four-part series, Decade of Destruction, will premiere on Frontline on public television next Tuesday. The companion book is published by Henry Holt. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.